Job chapter 3. As we move into these series of passages that we're going to be talking about for the next several weeks, we need to be reminded of some things, and I will remind us as we go through this. By the way, how many of you, is this the first time that you've actually had to read through the entire book of Job? Raise your hand. Good. That's great. Job is one of the books that people don't spend a lot of time in. They get past the first couple of chapters, which is a story, and then they get into the poetry, and they get lost along about chapter 3 or 4 or 5, and they think to themselves, whoa, this is way over my head, or way below me, or something. It's out of my range. But as we work through this, I think you will see that it's not out of our range. As a matter of fact, the feelings that are revealed in Job are very much the feelings that we ourselves wrestle with. That's one of the reasons that Job has endured all through the centuries and is still one of the most powerful pieces of poetry ever written, and is known to be that. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. But as I was beginning, Job actually is synonymous with unjust suffering. And there are some things that we find out about Job in the first couple of chapters that set the tone for everything else in the book. And that if you don't know them, if you don't understand what happened in the first two chapters that set the context for everything else that Job does, you will misunderstand and probably find yourself either agreeing with Job or agreeing with his friends. Job's situation is outlined in those first two chapters as essentially a test of his faith. And we learned some things last week in looking at this, and I would like to remind us of them, and we'll need to be reminded, as I mentioned before, we'll need to be reminded throughout the book. The first is this, and that is that Job really is a good man suffering unjustly. Job is a good man suffering unjustly. Now, when we say suffering unjustly, what we mean is, and this has to be well understood, the suffering that he's enduring does not find its origins in any disciplinary action against his life. You guys following me? Understand that very clearly. The suffering that Job goes through is unjust in that sense. But let me ask you this. Do you think it's unjust in the ultimate sense for a human being to undergo suffering? What do you think? Do you think it's unjust? Do you think it's automatically unfair for God to allow suffering to come into the human life? No, it's not. No, you see, in the ultimate sense, it is not unjust for God to allow suffering into any human life. In order to make it unjust, the human would have to be so perfect that if anything bad happened to them, it would truly be a violation of eternal justice. Well, that's not true of any human being, and we know that from the Word of God. So in the ultimate sense, Job is suffering, in a sense, justly, right? Because he's a sinner like we are. Yet, for the purposes of the book, and in understanding why he's so angry, you must understand that he was truly, by all the standards of his day, a faithful and godly man. And the suffering that he endures, in the sense of a human being's understanding, really is unjust. He does not know, because it feels for all the world like God is disciplining him for something, and he doesn't understand why, and that motivates a lot of what his anger is and a lot of his feelings in the book. Now, when I said he was a good man, there again, we need to qualify it a little bit. When I say good man, I mean that he was a man who in his era walked with God. I'm not saying he was perfect. I'm not saying that he was sinless. He was far from sinless, as we all are. But in his era, which was the patriarchal period, about 2000 BC, he was a man who lived by faith. By the way, he wasn't Jewish, which is something unusual. People wonder, you know, what's this, a story about a guy who's not Jewish? That's right. There's no indicator that Job was Jewish. And yet he was a godly man. And the Lord had revealed himself to Job. Don't you wish you knew more about that? Because God revealed himself to Abraham in roughly the same period in history and built an entire nation, the Jewish nation, out of Abraham. Don't you wonder whatever happened to Job? Well, anyway, we have a situation in which we have a good man. That is, he lived by faith. He really believed God. And he really did, in his era, what God asked him to do to demonstrate that faith. He made sacrifices. There was no priesthood. Job was not part of the Jewish economy. He didn't have a priest or anything like that. But he was his own priest. And the Lord said, in the patriarchal period, that's fine. He was a good man in that sense. He lived by faith. He lived by faith. He lived with a sense that he trusted God. And God had blessed him so much all through his life, that by the time Satan came and God said, I want to lift up my servant Job, who's such a wonderful man. Look at this guy. In spite of the fact that he lives in a fallen world, this man worships me. Look at him. And Satan then tested him because of that faith. It was, as a matter of fact, the strength of Job's faith that put him in the position where he became a test case for Satan's temptation. I ended the message last week by saying that God is a confident father, but he will allow us to be tested. The Lord said to Satan twice, that man will not cave in. Of course, God knew that. Satan did not know that. But he said it twice, that man will not cave in. It was Job's faith, being a good man and a faithful man, it was his faith that actually put him in the position where the trial was a little horrible. And so you're thinking to yourself, Lord, give me less faith, or at least keep me behind somebody else. You know, let there be somebody out there with a little more faith than me so that they take the heat instead of me. He was a good man, and it was his very goodness that put him in line for this trial. And by the way, if you've read the end of the story, which we all have, if you noticed, he put him in line also for multiplied blessings after the trial was over, which is always the way the Lord works. He's never a debtor to anybody. Nevertheless, the first thing we noticed about this man is he's a truly godly, good man who is suffering through no fault of his own, okay? And we call that, quote, unjust suffering. Not in the ultimate sense, but in the human sense, unjust suffering. Secondly, and note this carefully, God is still vitally interested and watching over Job all through this thing. We notice that from the first couple of chapters, that the Lord is the one who actually brings Job into the attention of everybody up in heaven. He's actually watching Job. He's aware of everything, and he's watching Job all through this entire lengthy process of trial that Job is going through. Now, Job doesn't know that God is watching. He doesn't sense God's grace and God's warmth in the presence of this trial. And that's part of the nature of a trial, is that you don't sense the presence of God in the midst of it all the time, okay? Nevertheless, don't make any mistake about it. The Lord has not lost track of Job, and he loves him, and he's very confident of him. Even though at the very end of the book, he comes back to Job and he says, Job, sit down, be quiet. I'm going to correct you on some of the things you've said, because Job gets pretty darn sassy in the process of this trial he goes through. God has watched him, though, all the way through. Don't fall into the thinking that God has left him. That's what Job thinks. Job sort of thinks God has left him or wonders what's going on. Don't you think that? Because the first two chapters remind us that God is watching him. And then the third thing that we noticed in the first two chapters, it's vital to carry through to the rest of the book, is that there is a reason for Job's suffering. There is a reason for Job's suffering. It's just that Job doesn't know what the reason is. Now, the reason I point that out is because we tend to say, well, Job suffered for no reason. That's not true. That's not true. There was a true reason for Job's suffering, but it was not punishment. We tend to think that the only way that you can validate suffering is as punishment. Think that through. Think philosophically for just a moment. Don't human beings tend to believe that the only valid reason for suffering in our lives is as a form of discipline and punishment? And if we've been good, do we not then deserve God to say, you've been good? You get a cookie. Really, that's what we do. That's the way we think. But the Lord has other reasons for suffering. besides discipline. This is part of the lesson of Job. It's part of, it has to be part of our theology and understanding all about suffering. And when we go through all this wisdom literature, Job and Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon, and we deal with all of the emotions of being human and walking in a fallen world, living in a fallen world, we must understand that part of the purpose for suffering has to do not with discipline, but with other things that we don't understand. But I want to make something very clear. Job did not suffer meaninglessly. One of the most horrible things that a person endures who is suffering is to think that their suffering is meaningless, that their pain has no redemptive quality to it, whether it's emotional pain or whether it's physical pain. And those are the two biggies. To think that their pain has no emotional, redemptive value, that God is wasting it, he's pouring it out on the ground, that the pain is meaningless and useless, that's something you don't have to live with, my friend. As a Christian, in Romans chapter 5, it says, we exalt in our tribulations, our pressures is the word, the hassles and the horror of living in this world. And Paul says, we exalt in that. And what he means is, because we've come to Jesus Christ and because we belong to God, like Job did in his era, we know that our pain is not meaningless. There is a purpose. Here's the problem. We don't know what the purpose is. Very often we don't. In fact, usually we don't. In fact, the times we think we do, often we find out later we didn't. Okay? But get this and get it very straight from the very beginning. The pain that Job experiences has a reason. It is a reason that is in the Lord. And we see a glimpse of it because he and Satan are dueling, so to speak. And Job is in the middle. You say, well, I think that's unfair for Job. Well, that gets back to our question of whether or not you believe God actually owes us anything. And it also gets back to the question of whether or not you believe Job, by the time it was really all over, by the end of the last chapter, whether Job would have said, I will worship God. You see, if you answer those questions correctly, I think you'll see that it's okay for God to do that. But he does have a reason. He does have a reason. God never does anything without a reason. He is not whimsical. He is not accidental. He doesn't ever say, oops, I guess we'll make the best of this. Okay? So let's, as we're dealing with all of the emotion, which we will deal with tonight, as we talk about how horrible Job's life is, and as he talks about it, let's not fall into the trap of thinking like he's thinking entirely, okay? Or thinking like his three buddies who come to sort of try and comfort him and end up really hurting his feelings. We don't want to think like any of those guys. We've got to get it straight. That's why the first two chapters are there. Now, for those of you who weren't with us or don't know anything about the book of Job, suffice it to say that his life has completely fallen apart. He's lost his entire family with the exception of his wife, who has advised him to commit suicide. So he's a man whose whole world has completely caved in. Okay, and he's lost his livelihood, and he's lost his physical health. At the time that his friends come to visit him, the end of chapter 2, he is sitting in an ash heap. He used to be a man to be reckoned with in his entire nation, one of the most important men in his nation. Now he is a man that when people look at him, they gag. Seriously, when his friends came to see him, they didn't recognize him. They were so grieved by his appearance that as soon as they saw him, they started crying. Imagine that. Your friends come to see you. Knock, knock, knock. Open the door. Oh, no! Look at you! Well, that's exactly it. And they couldn't make him feel any worse at that point. He already felt horrible. He's covered with boils. One boil can keep you awake 24 hours a day. One. Anywhere on your body. Just one. He is covered with them. He's sitting on an ash heap taking pieces of pottery and scraping the pus off of his skin. He has no drugs. He has no doctor. He has no help from anybody. His life is in the trash heap. That's the situation. And he has no idea why. Now, as we move into this, and as his friends come from a long ways away to come and talk to him, and they've known him for some time, they've all been wise men together, and they've advised other people together. His three friends come to encourage him. Bear in mind that the theology of the day was very, very simple. And you might want to take note of this. As you see Job in this situation, and as you understand his friends are coming to talk to him, they're all godly men. They all know the Lord. None of them are pagans. None of them are evil at all. They're good, godly men, mistaken, but godly. Bear in mind this. The prevailing theology of the day was that God runs the universe on a strictly legalistic basis, founded in outward behavior. Their view of God was very simple. It was very simple. What you do is what you get. And there's a direct proportional relationship. If you do good, you get good. You do a lot of good, you get a lot of good back. If you do bad, you get bad. And if you do a lot of bad, you get a lot of bad back. It's a simple, straightforward mathematical equation. That's the way their theology was. They believed that you could, well, you know, if you wanted to be successful in life, you served God. And that if anybody who served God and walked with God would automatically be successful. You could write it down, righteousness equals material prosperity. Righteousness equals material prosperity. And the opposite is also true, as with mathematical equations. Unrighteousness equals material ruin. Unrighteousness equals material ruin. Now, the nice thing about a nice, neat little theology like that is that it helps you understand the world. And you can always tell who's who. Anybody who's doing really well and has lots of money and is real healthy and is looking good in the world, they must be righteous people, because if this is true, then God wouldn't have blessed them otherwise. And anybody who's down and out and having a hard time and everything's gone south on them must automatically have sinned. They must be evil people, because God wouldn't have allowed that to happen to him otherwise. It's a real simple, straightforward way to deal with God. It's completely wrong. Now, we know that as Christians because Jesus lived out the opposite of this. He was actually treated horribly all of his life and died as a criminal, and yet he's God in the flesh. So we know better than these things, but this is a real common theology even among people today. And it is this that's in the minds of these men as they come. And furthermore, you guys, it might be a shock to you, this is what's in Job's mind. Job shares this view of life. And that's why he's so upset at God for allowing this to happen. He doesn't understand what he's done wrong, because he actually shares, though he's a godly man, a faithful man, he shares this actual view of life. That you can tell if God loves you by how much money you have. And you can tell if you're doing well with God by how good your life looks on the outside. Incidentally, Jesus' own disciples shared this view. Did you know that? In John chapter 9, in the Gospel of John, there was a man who was born blind, and they said to Jesus, "Lord, did this man sin, or did his parents sin that he should be born blind?" What does that tell you when they ask that question? It's obvious they held the same view that the guys back in the patriarchal period held. Though it's never been taught by the Lord, he never told anybody that. Yet they held this view quite clearly. And Jesus answered them and said, it was not that this man sinned, nor was it that his parents sinned. But he adds a third option. He said, this man was born blind so that the works of God could be shown in his life. That's in John chapter 9, verses 2 through 5. And you can look it up when you get a chance. The Lord says there are other reasons for suffering. But back to Job. Realize that all the men in this story share the same view of life. And that is that God deals on this kind of legalistic deal where there's a direct correlation between what you do and what you get. And it's almost immediate. You know, it's this immediate thing where you can always tell who's good and who's not. The result, of course, is that when a person comes to comfort, if you have that theology, what happens? What does your comfort turn into if you have this theology? Your comfort turns into this. It turns into explaining and blaming. Because when you come across a person who was once walking with God and now they're on the ash heap and they're covered with sores and everything's fallen apart in their whole life, your theology is what these guys held, including Job. The way you will talk to that person is by trying to explain why it happened to them. And that is what gets these guys in so much trouble. And we're going to end this evening's Bible study eventually, I promise. We will end this evening. We haven't even got into the text yet, but we will, I promise. By talking about some advice on what not to do when you're comforting someone. But you'll notice that people with this kind of a view of life will comfort, quote unquote, by explaining, well, this is why this happened to you, and by blaming, it's your fault, or it's someone else's fault. And then sort of feeling like they've done their job. We've done our job if we've explained why this horrible thing happened. That makes me feel better. I feel so much better now that I've explained why your life is falling apart. And we just kind of, oh, yeah, that makes me feel better. And we walk away. Does it help you? Not even. Not even a little bit. The best thing these guys did was what they did in the very beginning, which was sit there for a week with him. The end of chapter 2, we'll plunge in and we'll go on and we'll see the emotions of what's going on. He's on the ash heap. These guys come with this theology. He's got this theology. Confusion reigns among these people. They have no idea what in the world's going on. Verse 13, they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. That's the wisest thing these guys did. Underline it and look at it. We'll come back to it. This is the best thing they did. They sat with him for 7 days and 7 nights. And he was thanking God that they were there, no doubt. He was glad they were there until everybody started talking. And Job starts it. Job starts it, and they respond to him, and then it's back and forth for the rest of the book. And the way the book goes, in case you don't know, is that Job starts talking, and then Eliphaz talks, then Job talks, then Bildad talks, then Job talks, then Zophar talks, then Job talks, and they go back and forth like this, and there's these cycles of dialogue and argument all the way through the book about what's happening to Job. It becomes this long argument where Job is saying, I don't deserve this, and his buddies are saying, well, yes, you do, as a matter of fact. And that's kind of how the dialogues go. So we start out with Job saying in chapter 3, the bottom line of chapter 3 is, I hate my life. I hate it. I hate it, and I wish that when I was born, I'd have died instantly. And he means it. He is serious. He wishes that he'd been stillborn. And that's in the poetry, this incredibly dramatic poetry. And it's the first thing his friends hear. They've sat there for a week with him, and he lifts up his voice and he begins to simply vent all of this deep feeling. I hate my life. I wish I was dead. Job said, verse 2 and verse 3, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night in which they said a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. He personifies all this. This is poetry, see? Strangle that day. Kill that day. Smother that day. Let it die. Torture it to death the day that I was born. Verse 7, behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light but have none. Neither let it see the breaking dawn. That day should never happen. Because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. Whoa. Why did I not die at birth? Verse 11. And come forth from the womb and expire. Why did the knees receive me? And why the breasts that I should suck? For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then, and I would have been at rest with the kings and with the councils of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver, or like a miscarriage which is discarded. I would not be as infants that never saw the light. That's what I want to be. There the wicked cease from raging, and there the weary are at rest. Speaking of death, the prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from the master. He's saying, oh, wow, to be dead. Oh, that would be great. To never have existed. Oh, that's even better yet. Oh, I wish I was dead. What a horrible thing to say about yourself. And not only say it, not only think it, but write this profound, weeping poetry about it. Incidentally, let me warn you about something. Don't take very much of your theology of the afterlife from Job, because he's only expressing stuff he thinks is true about life after death. He doesn't really know any of that stuff. He's just expressing it. And just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean it's true. I can't believe my pastor said that. Let me explain. I know that that's got you going, and wake up, hello. What I'm saying is that the Bible records mistakes that people say. Okay? That's all I'm saying. The Bible records stuff that people say in which they were obviously mistaken, and they find out later that they were. And one of the books in which some of that stuff is found is the book of Job. So be careful about that. Some of the stuff said by Job and his friends is not really true. We find out later. It's just their idea of how things were. Other things that they say we find out later are very true. So we'll see some of that as we go back and forth. But he says, he thinks that if he'd never been born, it would be better. He's mistaken. He's mistaken. It is not better never to have been born. Okay? Let's understand that. But he feels like it ought to be better because he feels so lousy about his life. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'll bet you in this room there are more than a handful who have thought these things at one or more times during your life. That you have thought, I want to die. I'm ready for the Lord to take me. In fact, it would be nice if it had already been over with before now. You say, well, do Christians really think that? Oh, yeah. Especially Christians who know what heaven is like. They are looking forward to being there, and they look around at the world, and they get real tired of it. God does not give us the option, but people do think it. Now, Job is doing more than thinking it. He's putting it into inspired poetry, and the feeling is so powerful. His friends are listening to this. He goes on in verse 20. Why is the light given to him who suffers and life to the bitter of soul? What's the use of it all? who long for death, but there is none. They dig for it more than for hidden treasures. Who rejoice greatly. They exult when they find the grave. Why do they have to suffer? People who just hate their lives. Why does this have to happen, Lord? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? You see, he's starting to get a little theological here. God's not telling me what's going on, and I hate this. I hate it. Why am I even alive? It feels like a caged animal. For my groaning comes at the sight of my food. My cries pour out like water. For what I fear has come upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. And I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. I got a picture of him sitting there with his eyes closed and ashes all over him and his body looking like one giant sore, and he's crying out to God, and his three friends are hanging around listening to this. And there may have been more that we don't even see. This may have gone on for longer than it took to read this, but you can see what he's saying. I hate my life. I hate it. By the way, the next time you think that godly people never grieve heavily, that they never cry out to God in the lowest depths of despair, think again. Think again. You know, it's not really faithlessness on the part of Job. In fact, in a very real sense, listen carefully, it is Job's faith that has actually given rise to the anger that he feels against his life. Because he knows that God is there. He knows he's there. And that he's allowed this. If he didn't know that God was there, he could say, well, it's fate or some mindless thing. But because he knew that God was there, the very fact that he knew that God was there and that he allowed this is part of what causes all of this psychic pain inside of him. You see? Yes, faithful people cry out to God and they will beat their fists on God's chest and they will weep and cry at his feet at times. And it doesn't mean that they're not faithful. And it doesn't mean that they don't love God. It just means they hate what they're going through. And you know something? This is going to sound like heresy too, but hang with me. It's okay to hate what you're going through. It's okay to hate what you're going through. It's better to like what you're going through if you're going through fun stuff right now. But if you're going through really bad stuff and you hate it, God never says you have to like this. What he does say is, you have to trust me. That he says, and that he insists on. You have to trust me. But he never says you have to like everything that happens in your life. Nor does he say you have to explain it, or explain it away, or figure it out. And we'll talk more about that at the end of this evening. So here's Job, pours out his heart, and it is the archetypical grieving process. He is angry, and he gets angrier before this book is done. Well, Eliphaz just can't take it anymore. Eliphaz is his friend, who is a better theologian than he is a comforter. And he comes and he says, "Excuse me, Job, may I speak?" Chapter 4, Eliphaz the Temanite answered. He said, "If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient?" Vexed is the word. "But who can refrain from speaking?" Certainly not Eliphaz, and none of his buddies could either, but they should have, but they couldn't refrain. "Behold, you have admonished many." Job, you've been a wise guy. "You have admonished many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. But now it's come to you, and you are vexed. You are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" What's he saying? He's saying, "Job, you used to be a wise guy. Suck it up, Job. You were a man who gave a lot of good counsel. Now, physician, heal thyself. Make it better. Come on, Job. We don't want to hear you getting angry about your situation." It's easy to say that when you're not the one covered with boils. Isn't that it? "Oh, come on, Job. You know better than to say all that stuff. Now, I got to rebuke you here a little bit, Job." No, you don't. As a matter of fact, Job has some choice words for Eliphaz in a few minutes. But Eliphaz isn't finished. He goes on with a little more of his exhortation. He says, "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, and where were the upright ever destroyed?" You see what he's getting back to is that theological position that they all share. Remember, Job, even though you used to be a wise guy, and, you know, I know that you still trust God, hey, don't we all know that innocent people don't suffer this way? Verse 8, "According to what I've seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. By the breath of God they perish, and at the blast of his anger they come to an end. The roaring of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, the teeth of the young lion are broken, the lion perishes for lack of prey, and the whelps of the lioness are scattered." What's he saying? The elder is destroyed and the children are too. What just happened to Job? What's Eliphaz, in his gentle way, really saying? He's saying, "Well, Job, it's obviously your own fault that these things have happened." Then he pulls the really biggie. He says, "Now listen, a word was brought to me stealthily, and my ear received a whisper of it amid disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night." He says, I had a vision. "When deep sleep falls upon men," verse 14, "dread came upon me and trembling and made all my bones shake. And a spirit passed by my face, and the hair of my flesh bristled up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence, and then I heard a voice. Quote, can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his maker, or more pure than his maker? The Lord puts no trust even in his own servants, and against his angels he charges error. In other words, he even examines angels. How much more will he examine those who dwell in houses of clay, human beings, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth? Between morning and evening they are broken in pieces, unobserved. They perish forever. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them? They die, yet without wisdom. He says, that's what the Spirit told me. I had a vision. Let me tell you something, Job. I know you're in a bad state of affairs here. I know that this is really terrible, but I know this, his false theology. He says, I know my false theology. Of course, he didn't call it that. I know that God never allows bad stuff to happen to good people. So therefore, if bad stuff has happened to you, I know that you must not be all that good deep down inside. Furthermore, I base this on a vision I had, which I believe came from God. Did you ever talk to somebody who told you God told them to tell you something? And when they told you what God told them to tell you, you thought to yourself, I don't really think that's from God. That's happened to me more times than I can count. How do you argue with a person who says, I had a vision from God? How do you tell them, you know, I disagree? The minute you say, I disagree, well, you're just the most unspiritual person in the whole world. If you say, well, I don't think you had that vision, or I don't think it applies to me, or I disagree with what you're saying, well, immediately, if the person has said, thus saith the Lord, what are you going to say? Nothing. There's nothing you can say. You just have to sit there and take it and wonder if they've been drinking their bathwater. Now, the question is, whether or not did he have the vision? He could easily have had the vision. But there's no question, if you know the book of Job, that he's completely mistaken in his application of it to Job. Because the moral of the story of this vision just simply backs up his false theology. I don't know where this vision came from. Maybe it came from the Lord in a different context. But I'll tell you this, and it's an absolute fact. If you look through the whole book of Job, it was misapplied in this man's life. Eliphaz used this quote-unquote vision from God to accuse Job, essentially, of being responsible for all of his own problems with regard to this test he was going through. Be careful when you say, God told me to tell you something. Be careful when you take the Lord's name. My advice is leave room for the other person. If they're a believer in Jesus, leave room for that other person to disagree, because it really is up to them to discern whether or not the word you think you're giving them is really for them. And especially this is true, if it's a word of judgment. If you think that the Lord has spoken to you to share with someone else something that God is doing that they are too dumb to find out on their own, which is the way it comes across a lot of times. God told me, because obviously you got your phone off the hook. And the feeling is, well, you know, why didn't he tell me? Why, and you know, am I that much of a doofus and I'm not hearing what God's saying in my life, you know? Be careful that when you say stuff, especially if it's hard stuff, you give the person you're talking to the ability to say, let me pray about this. Don't do the Elijah complex thing. You are not Elijah. And I am not Elijah. There are no Elijahs in the new covenant, okay? So give people the opportunity. Yeah, God speaks. And yes, he speaks through us to each other. But let's be careful when we're saying that he did. Let's be absolutely sure. In Eliphaz's case, it was a complete mistake on his part. He goes on, as if he hadn't said enough. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer? In other words, go ahead and yell if there's anybody that's listening. To which of the holy ones will you turn? You're going to turn to one of the angels? Because vexation slays the foolish man. Anger is what he's talking about. Slays the foolish man, and anger kills the simple. I have seen the foolish taking root, and I cursed his abode immediately. His sons were far from safety. They were even oppressed in the gate. Neither is there a deliverer for them. His harvest the hungry devour, and they take it to a place of thorns, and the schemer is eager for his wealth. For affliction does not come from the dust, neither does trouble sprout from the ground. Because man is born for trouble as sparks fly upward. You know what he's saying at this point? He's on a roll. And what he's saying is, essentially, go ahead and call out, Job. Go ahead and yell. That's what Job had been doing. He'd been yelling, I want to die. I am so sick of this. And Eliphaz says, go ahead and yell if there's anybody that's going to listen. But he said, I'm telling you, I have watched evil people, Job, and I have noticed evil. that their children don't fare very well. But the interesting thing is, this is sort of true in life. But it's the wrong thing to be saying to Job. His kids were just killed. All of them. In one day. Through no fault of his own. But you see what Eliphaz is doing.
Well, this has been my experience.
And the vague, implied accusation against Job is so obvious. And then he gives the true advice, but at a bad time. As for me, I would seek God, and I would place my cause before God, who does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number. And he gives rain on the earth, and he sends water on the fields, and he sets on high those that are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety, and he frustrates the plotting of the shrewd so that their hand cannot attain success. And he captures the wise by their own shrewdness, and the advice of the cunning is quickly thwarted. And by day they meet with darkness, and they grope at noon as in the night, but he saves from the sword of their mouth, and the poor from the hand of the mighty. So the helpless has hope, and unrighteousness must shut its mouth. Ooh, it's all true. It's a wonderful psalm. Matter of fact, it goes on to the end of the chapter. Oh, the Lord is so good. Look, behold, how happy is the man whom, verse 17, whom God reproves. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. By the way, that's the only quote from Job in the New Testament, and it's in Hebrews 12. Don't despise the discipline of the Almighty. It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. It's so wonderful. But it's absolutely the wrong thing to say to this guy at the time. What he's doing, and he does it all the way down to verse 27, he gives Job a theology lesson. And what he's saying is, Job, what you need to do is just call out to God, because God is so wonderful. And Job is thinking, I don't know this. I haven't done this. You think I haven't called out to God? You think I haven't been beaten on the doors of heaven about this? And yet Eliphaz is just blank. At this point, his point is not to comfort at all. He's just given a theology lesson. When he finally gets done, takes a breath, chapter 6 comes in and Job answers him. Job answered and says, well, actually, Job's main point in this speech, and we're going to stop at the end of chapter 6, even though it's the middle of his speech. We'll pick up the middle of the speech again next week. But his main thing is, don't you tell me to trust God. You can just kind of feel the heat off of him as he speaks to Eliphaz. He says, oh, that my vexation were actually weighed. Now, it's interesting because there's a play on words here. The term vexing, vexation, impatience that is used by Eliphaz is used by Job. He says, you want to know about vexation? You want to know about anger? If you could weigh it, it would outweigh you. You want to know about how I feel? You have no idea how I feel. Do you ever feel like saying that to somebody who's talking to you? You have no idea how I feel. Get out of my face. That's kind of the way Job is responding at this point. He says, if it could be laid in the balance together with my iniquity, let me tell you, I am just as vexed as I can be over what's going on to me, because I think it's totally unfair. Verse 3. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the seas, and that's why my words have been rash. That's why I've said all this radical stuff. It's because of all the horrible things that have happened to me. You want me to call on God? He says in verse 4, the arrows of the Almighty are within me. They're poison my spirit drinks. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray over his grass? Or does the ox low over his fodder? What he's saying is, listen, even animals, when they're getting what they need, will not cry out about it. When I'm weeping and crying out, he says, it's obvious that I'm not getting what I need in this situation. And he's implying, I'm not getting it from you, Eliphaz. You came here to comfort me, and now you're accusing me. Verse 6, can something tasteless be eaten without salt? Is there any taste in the white of an egg? And he got that right. That's really true. Ugh. Verse 7, my soul refuses to touch them. You know, as a matter of fact, mine does too. They're loathsome food to me. He says, listen, you have no idea how sick of all of this I am. He says, you want to see anger? My words have been rash, that's true, but they are in keeping with how horrible my life is. Oh, that my request may come to pass and that God would grant my longing. Would that God would be willing to crush me and that he would loose his hand and cut me off. I want to die. I want him to kill me, Eliphaz. That's actually what I want. But it is still my consolation and I rejoice in unsparing, even though I am in unsparing pain, that I have not denied the words of the Holy One. He still maintains that he loves God and trusts God. He cannot understand what's going on, and he hates what he's in. But notice he says, I have not denied his words. So he gets kind of back in Eliphaz's face. And he basically continues that down through the rest of the chapter. Verse 14, for the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend, lest he forsake the fear of the Almighty. When your friend is despairing and he's in really bad straits, not unrepentant sin, but he's just hurting, you don't go and accuse him of stuff. He says, man, you guys haven't been good friends. He says, my brothers have acted deceitfully, like a wadi, that's a creek in Israel, like the torrents of these creeks which vanish, which are turbid because of the ice and into which the snow melts, and then they become waterless, and then they become silent. When it's hot, they vanish from their place. What he's saying is, you guys are like these dry creek beds, and Israel's filled with these. The whole Middle East is filled with these dry creek beds. When it rains, they gush. They will wash you away and when the rainy season comes. But then, as soon as you need the water, it's gone. And he says, that's the way you guys are. You've been my friends. Man, yeah, you're gushing with all kinds of wonderful wisdom when I don't need it. Now that I need it, you're like these dried up wadis. Get out of my face. The paths of their course wind along. They go to nothing and perish. And he just goes into this artistic description of how these useless creek beds are and how that's basically what they've done to him. Look at verse 22. He says, have I said, give me something? Did I ask you guys for anything? Did I ask you to make a bribe for me? Did I ask you did I even ask you to come here is the idea. You know, did I ask you to come here and get on my case like you're doing? And then in verses 24 and following, he goes right to the point, teach me and I will be silent. Show me how I have erred. You say I'm sinning. You say it's my fault. You're implying my kids died because of what I did. Tell me what I did. Everybody knows my reputation. What did I do? Now remember, they're all under the same theological position. They all believe, even Job believes, if you do good, God will give you good. If you do bad, God will give you bad. Always. And never the twain shall meet. So that's why he's saying this. Have I done evil? Tell me. Because he knew he hadn't. He knew he hadn't. He didn't deserve this by his understanding. Honest words are not painful. Actually, the NIV renders this a little differently. It says, how painful are honest words? And you can render it either way. But what do your arguments prove? Do you mean to correct what I say and treat the words of a despairing man like wind? How do you treat the words of a despairing person when they rattle off and they say radical, stupid stuff? And they're hurt and they're angry and they're frustrated and they're beating their fist on the table. How do you treat the words of a person like that? What do? You take every word out and try and correct it. Try and make them think straight all of a sudden. Try and force it down their throat. Job says, get out of my face. Stop trying to correct everything I say. Don't you understand what's going on here? Do you intend to reprove my words? Verse 27. You would even cast lots for orphans and barter over your friend. That's what you're doing. You're not here to help me. Now, please look at me and see if I am lying to your face. Desist now. Verses 29 and 30 sort of softens a little bit. He says, stop it. Come on. Back off. Desist now. Let there be no more injustice. Desist. Stop. My righteousness is yet in it. Job says, I'm okay. I haven't done what you think I've done. I don't know what you think I've done, but I haven't done it. So back off. You know me better than that. Which, of course, they went on and on. They just nailed him for the rest of the book. But he says, come on, back off. Verse 30. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? I know what's going on. I know the difference between right and wrong, and I know if I've sinned, and I haven't. What a horrible scene. What a horrible scene at this point. And we're going to stop there. Isn't that happy? We're going to stop in that horrible scene, and we're going to pick up, because in the next chapter, next week, we'll take some more time to look at it. He gets mad at God, who has broad enough shoulders to take the anger of humanity against him. And we'll see what Job says, and then we'll hear a little bit more what his other friends say. But I want to close this evening with having kind of emotionally tasted a little bit of what's going on in these interchanges. I'd like to close with a couple of just thoughts, because every single one of us is called upon to comfort people at times. We all are in the ministry, and we all are called upon at one time or another to comfort a friend who's just really facing horrible, horrible times. You know, and sometimes you can actually point to situations that have brought this about, even in your friend's life. But I'm going to suggest that that's not always the wisest thing in the world to do. Let me mention just two thoughts, and we'll continue along this vein as we go through the book of Job. We'll be talking about applying this to ministry. We'll be talking about how to minister to people who are really hurting and how not to. We'll get some more pieces of advice as we go along. But let me just mention two things that are stated sort of positively. If you're a person who has a friend who's hurting, I mean seriously hurting, I'm not talking that they got a flat tire here. We're talking people whose lives have crashed. Remember these two things. Number one, your presence is better comfort than your theology. Your presence is better comfort than your theology. Don't try and explain everything to them. Explanation isn't the same as comfort. Now, people might ask, and sometimes there are some brief explanations that can be made. But generally speaking, when a person is in the throes of grief, heavy-duty grief, your simple presence is far more comfort than anything you say by way of theology. And I'll tell you why. Because part of living on earth is living in the mystery, not knowing why things happen. Okay? Let's get this straight, you guys. We don't know why God allows things. Let's stop pretending that we do know why. I mean, we are evangelical Christians and we do know the Lord. I'm not denying that. And we have the Spirit. I'm not denying that. And we have His Word. I'm not denying that. And because of His wisdom and because of His Word, we do know a lot of things. We can see some broad principles that the world does not understand. All of that is true and all of that is good. But you know, even with all the principles that we know, there are still stuff that happens every day and we go, Lord, why? Why? And like Job, we say, why? Why me? Why him? Why her? Why this? Why now? Why? And part of living on earth is living with that. Don't think that you will ever get to a point on earth where you will not have questions like that. And stop trying to explain everything away theologically. Now, if you're in a good headspace and things aren't crashing all around you, and you're not comforting a person whose life has fallen apart, and you want to do some philosophical investigation, there are some good things written by Christians about the purposes of pain on earth and so on. But it is of no value when you're actually comforting somebody to take that and say, well, here's why you're going through this. Your presence is what's needed, just to be there. Just to be there. Your presence is much better comfort than your theology. You know, these guys would have done well with one simple phrase. Let me give you a magic phrase. Can I give you a magic phrase that you can use, and it's the most wonderful phrase in the world when you need it. When you need this phrase, and you can use it at the appropriate moment, it sets you free. It is like magic. It is this phrase, I don't know. I don't know. Why is this happening to me, Pastor? I don't know. I don't know. But I love you. Now, that doesn't answer anything. It doesn't fix stuff. But it is far more comfort. I mean, at least because you don't know. And when you go to somebody you think ought to know, and they say, I don't know either, that makes you feel better. Doesn't it? It makes me feel better. If I'm really confused about something and I go to somebody and I think it might be my fault and they say, well, you know what? I don't see either. I don't understand it either. That makes me feel better. At least I know we're both in the same boat. I don't know. That's a magic phrase that you can use when people say, why? And you can look into their eyes and you can say, I do not know. But I'm with you. I'm with you. Your presence, you see, is much more comfort than your theology. Secondly, your respect is better encouragement than your solutions. Your respect of that person is better encouragement than your solutions. Because grief is not something you can fix. You will never fix grief, and don't ever even try to fix another person's grief. In fact, don't even fix your own. You can't fix it. Grief can't be fixed. There is not a solution for it. But it needs to be respected so that you look at them with respect and you say, I respect what you're going through. Or you convey, I respect you. I respect what you're going through. I'll be quiet in the presence of this pain. I am not going to try and fix you with a verse like Romans 8:28, which is true, and I love Romans 8:28. All things do work together for the good of those that love God and are called according to His purpose. It's a marvelous promise, but never, ever feed it to a person who's just lost a loved one. Never do that. It's too much of a pill for them to take right then. Much better to simply respect the grief, which is what Job's friends couldn't do. They kept trying to do the fix thing, you know, and the explain thing. Never do that. Just respect the grief. Your respect is much better encouragement than your solution to their problem. I'm going to get more practical. I'm going to tell you exactly how to do it. Okay, I'm going to give you three things to do. Try this. Just nod. Don't place the blame because it never helps. Just nod. Make eye contact and nod. They're laying out a horrible thing to you, and you're thinking, I got to say something. I got to open my mouth and say something. I got to make something better. I got to make them feel better. I got to say something. No, you don't. You can just nod. And do not place any blame. Don't place the blame. It doesn't help. It's a form of explaining that we do that just doesn't help. Even if you think there is blame here to be placed, well, this happened because of this and this and this and this. Just bite your tongue. You don't need to do that. Just nod. The person's weeping and they're crying and they're hurting. You just nod. Number two, just listen. Don't correct or respond to the anger that they feel. Just listen. You don't have to. They'll scream and rant and rave. I've had people scream and rant and rave in my office and at my home and in my car, and any place I end up talking to folks who are going through real, real hard times, scream and rant and rave and hit things and throw things and get upset and swear and cry. You don't respond to any of that. You just be there. You just listen. It's okay. I have seen every conceivable human emotion in the course of grief. In my office or in the conference room and places that I've counseled. Many of you have as well. You don't have to respond to any of that, and you shouldn't. Let it go. It's like pus coming out of a wound. Just wipe it off. Let it bleed. It's okay. Because that's part of the process. Your respect is better encouragement than your solution. Here's the third thing to do. Just pray. Don't lecture and don't philosophize. Pray. Don't lecture and don't philosophize. There's time for philosophy later. And there may even be time for lecture later. But not now. Not when it's just erupting. Not when the whole world's caving in on your friend. Just pray. And by the way, one hug is worth 1,000 words. A good hug is just worth
almost anything. Just walk. There's a true. There's several true stories along this line, but I'll tell you one about a man down south, minister, who basically went through just an absolutely horrendous, horrendous life-breaking experience and was crushed. He was in his home, and a lot of times people won't come because they don't know what to say. When a person's life is so crushed, they don't know what to say. They're friends and they love them and they pray for them, but they don't know what to say, so they don't come around. But one guy did the most wonderful and marvelous thing. He said, this is the man who was comforted, said this was the best thing that happened to him. His friend came to him, knocked on the door, it was nighttime. He opens the door. His friend walked in, big burly guy. And they're both Christians, of course. And so they both knew that they were trusting God. This big burly guy was standing outside the door. He walked in as soon as his friend opened the door, just wrapped his arms around him, just bear hugged him like that. Didn't break his spine or anything, you know, just kind of bear hugged him. And hugged him for, you know, longer than the simple church hug. Now, the simple church hug can only go for, you know, like 2 or 3 seconds. But this went for, you know, like a minute or so. And that's a long hug. And they both were crying, just hung on to him. When he was done hugging, crying, about a minute or two, whatever, he turned around, walked straight back out the door. And the guy who was in the grief said, he walked out with a load of grief. He took it right off my shoulders. Isn't that amazing? Now see, that's presence. That's respect. I'm respecting the grief that you're going through. I know I can't fix it, and I'm not going to try. I'm just going to respect it. I'm just going to pray. I'm not going to try and make a solution. I'm not going to try and make it go away. If I could, I would, but I can't. Somehow, miraculously, that actually is the way we comfort each other as Christians. And we learn it by contrast from Job's friends who didn't do any of that stuff. And Job's crying out to him saying, I wish you had, but they didn't. Let's bow our heads. Father, we all wish that you would make the pain go away in our lives and in the lives of the people we love. But it is so obviously not your plan to always do that, at least not as quickly as we want. So please, Lord, teach us the skills necessary to encourage one another, because some of these skills do not come naturally to us. We are born fixers. We give solutions and theology and all kinds of things. And we know there are times for that, Lord, but at the moment of grief, please teach us sensitivity. Please teach us quietness. Please teach us to simply be there for the people we love. And in the process, we pray that your grace will flow through our lives to people who suffer. We cannot and do not understand all of the suffering around us. Oh, we know that ultimately it's because of sin in the world. That's true. But we don't understand why it would happen to one person and not another at this moment. So, Father, give us simply the ability to trust you and minister to one another, to just be who we are, useful to you to bring comfort. And we thank you, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen.